Good morning.
So last time, Serge talked about more about bitwise operators. So we had this idea of these operators that worked bit by bit. And well, often we only wanted to do something to part of a number. So a way we could do that is we could figure out what bits we wanted to do the thing to and make a number we called a mask that selected those bits by having ones in those places typically and perform some operation on just those bits. And we learned that sort of and corresponded to like if you wanted to keep certain bits or corresponded if you wanted to set certain bits, and XOR corresponded if we wanted to flip certain bits. We also mentioned this complement operator that the important thing is don't confuse it with our complement operator. Of course, I have this upside down. Is tilde. Don't confuse it with the logical negation operator, which just checks if the value is zero or not zero. And also don't confuse it with the minus sign, which multiplies by negative one. And Serge went through how to do this. Solve this ternary operation, so doing an if-else, basically, with mostly bitwise operations. We kind of cheated a little bit and used, like, addition or subtraction and a few other things, and the exclamation point operator, but we wrote ended up having code which basically didn't do any actual conditional jumps. And we also talked about solving a problem where we said, oh, let's check if any bit is set. How do we do that? We can OR all the bits together, because one ORed with anything is one, zeros ORed together stay zero, so if we OR all the bits together, we'll get one if any bit is set. And when we did that the naive way, it was like incredibly many operations, but what we realized is, well, our bitwise OR operation, you know, if we have 32-bit numbers, it always does 32 ORs, and kind of our naive way of doing the operation didn't take advantage of that. It only basically used one bit of the results. So we can do better by using more than one bit of results. And we had this pattern that came up where basically we had this kind of tree where we fanned in these values to our single value. And this pattern comes up a lot when we're doing bitwise operations, and also other things where we have a way of doing multiple operations in parallel. Some questions on bitwise operators topics? Okay. And we also talked about ISAs and microarchitecture. So one thing is, what's the difference between the two? So the ISA was that machine and assembly, machine code and assembly language interface. So it's basically what your compiler sees. So our compiler targets an ISA. And that ISA, that assembly language and machine code, that can be implemented in a bunch of different ways. And we call those sort of implementations microarchitectures. And we can have very different designs for different microarchitectures. And since we learned there's a lot of ISAs, we wanted to think about, like, what are people's goals in designing ISAs? And very commonly, there's like kind of two things we're thinking about. One thing is, what are going to be properties of a typical implementation? Is it going to be fast? Is it going to be small? And so on. Doesn't mean all implementations are going to be that way, but what we do in our ISA, like, for example, how many instructions we have there be, you know, is going to affect that. I think we briefly mentioned this idea of RISC, this reduced instruction set computer, versus CISC, the complex instruction set computer. And these are kind of two different design philosophies that have been out there. And people often say an instruction set is RISC or CISC. Usually, you know, it's not completely clear cut. But from a high level point of view, these have kind of two different design goals. The RISC people have this goal where they want to make the instructions easy to implement so they can focus on making the most efficient hardware implementation of that. And the ISA design kind of focuses first on what can we do efficiently in hardware. In these kind of CISC philosophy, they want to focus on making like the assembly language useful. And and kind of worry about how do we implement this in hardware later. So, and we'll talk a little more about ISAs as our first topic for today. So questions about sort of ISAs versus microarchitectures, or this RISC philosophy versus this CISC philosophy? So beyond these sort of high-level ISA goals, if you look at what ISAs do, they also differ in a bunch of other ways. So like one obvious way we can think of differences is we can look at kind of easy-to-measure properties, or kind of easy-to-measure properties of ISAs, like how long are the instructions in machine code, how many registers do we have, like, and by registers, I mean general purpose registers like RAX through R15, those types of registers, not special registers. And how many instructions do they have? Now, counting instructions is actually a little tricky because, like, is move 32 bits a different instruction than move 64 bits? Depends who you ask. But I have a chart where I did this for a bunch of ISAs, including the one you're probably most familiar with now, XE664. The one we're going to use for a lot of assignments that are coming up, YD664, and a bunch of other ISAs that are out there and possibly interesting. So you can see there's actually a lot of choices here, and you know, when they're making these choices, they're kind of making compromises as far as those goals go. If you have a lot of registers, then you probably can't have a really compact implementation. If you have very few registers, then that's kind of inconvenient for writing efficient code because we have to go back to memory and back a lot of time. If we have a lot of instructions, we would think that makes it, you know, easier to write good assembly that does things. Maybe that's not really true, but that's probably the idea. If you have few, then your hardware doesn't have to be as complex, and maybe you can implement those fewer instructions more efficiently. If we have our instructions take up variable sizes, then maybe our programs will be shorter because instructions like, you know, say push don't need to take up as much space as an instruction like move a big value into a register. But if we do that, then the hardware that actually reads those instructions is going to be more complex, as we'll see later in this semester. So questions on these sorts of, you know, these high level, these numerical choices that we have to make. Yes?
So I see that the ISA has like fewer instructions, and that's normally for like mobile devices. Is it normally true that like mobile devices and embedded systems use RISC-like ISAs, and like larger computers use CISC-like, or is that?
So question, is it true that sort of embedded systems typically use RISC-like ISAs and larger computers typically use CISC-like ISAs? So it depends what we mean by embedded. So if we're talking like cell phones, that's probably not at the point where that difference, where how efficiently you can make the processor like actually comes into play. If we're talking about like some device you want to cost 50 cents, probably. Though it might not still not be RISC-like, because as we'll see, there's things that RISC-like ISAs do that some small processors won't do, because RISC-like ISAs are not only focusing on making the processor simple, but kind of making it expose what's efficient in hardware, which might not be what's convenient in for assembly programming. And on embedded devices, sometimes we like don't care about speed that much, for example. And I guess another thing is that we talked about how there's the difference between ISAs and microarchitecture. And this is very true today for many of our popular ISAs. So for example, like the 32-bit x86 dates back to the 80s. And how we've built processors has changed a lot since then. But we still use that ISA. So the implementation doesn't really look like what they had in mind when they designed the ISA. And this is probably also true of ARM, even though ARM, I don't think, is quite as old. Other questions? So some other choices that ISAs make are how certain types of instructions work. And we're going to talk about a few selected ones. Come up a lot. So one is that in all the assembly languages you've seen, the way jumps work are you do a comparison, and separately you have this conditional jump instruction. And this required us to have condition codes. And some ISAs have said, well, that's kind of annoying. And I've instead decided to have separate instructions that do a comparison and a jump together. And that's the only way they support doing, you know, conditional jumps. Another choice that we see is made is that we learned about this way of specifying memory addresses. And that's a choice x86 makes. If you're making a new instruction set, you might say, maybe that's not what I really want to do. So you might support different ways of accessing memory or specifying operands in general. So, you know, we have x86's way where we can specify a memory location with two registers and two numbers. That's like pretty complicated. And there's other things that x86 doesn't support that you might imagine you want to. So for example, ARM lets you do shift registers by a constant in the operand for an instruction. So just like we can like add two values together to form an address in x86, you can shift a register in an instruction in the same way that takes an operand. Or a very old instruction set called VAX, it let you do sort of a double dereference as an instruction operand. So rather than just once, you can do it twice. And you can see that these are things that might be convenient for certain types of programs, but you know, also kind of which ones you choose, that's a decision you're making when you design your instruction set. That's going to affect your hardware complexity, and well, if you choose things that aren't actually useful, like if no one actually cares about doing shifts, you just implemented something no one cares about. And another big source of variation that I'm mentioning mainly because I don't think you've seen assembly language where this comes up, is how many operands there are. So a lot of instruction sets support three operands for a typical instruction, a source, a second source, and a destination. You're used to x86, where we have a source and a second source, which is also the destination. There's advantages and disadvantages here. So the advantage of the first version is that we don't have to write as many moves. The disadvantage is that if we do that, our instructions are bigger, because we have to specify three things instead of two. And VAX, which was probably the most CISC-like instruction set, they decided to implement everything. So they supported both, because they said wanted to do that. Some questions about these sort of particular instruction set choices. Okay, so there was a question earlier about the sort of what is typically, what's, you know, do RISC instruction sets do? So I'm going to give some properties that are typical of instruction sets following the RISC philosophy. So one, some of these are kind of obvious from that idea. They're based on what's efficient to do in hardware. And some of them are maybe a little less obvious. But these are things that typically instruction sets which have been called RISC have, and instruction sets which haven't been called RISC often don't have. So one property is fewer simpler instructions. So because we're focusing on ease of hardware, efficient hardware, we're going to implement fewer instructions. That means programs are going to have more instructions, because the instructions that are supported by the hardware do less per instruction. So if you want to do the same thing, you need more instructions to do that. So this is in hardware. So this implies more instructions in software. Another big choice that RISC-like systems typically make, and one that often isn't true in embedded processors, the very small embedded processors, is that they're usually separate instructions to access memory. What I mean by this is that if you want to access memory and then compute on a value, that value, you have to write two instructions. One instruction to take the value into a register, and another instruction to compute on the register. You can't actually compute on the value directly in memory like you're used to in x86-64 assembly. So this means we can't compute directly on values in memory. And we'll see when we talk about sort of how accessing memory works that this makes the hardware implementation a lot easier, but obviously it's a lot less convenient if you're writing assembly. And a consequence of that is this property here of having more registers. Since we're giving only, we were requiring separate instructions to move things from memory into registers, there's going to be more demand on registers. And that's, in the RISC philosophy, that's considered an okay trade-off. It's easy, relatively speaking, to put more registers in our hardware. And like that's based on the chip we're using that we're not using to implement more instructions. But that's something the compiler can definitely use, or assembly writers can hopefully use at least. Another property here is fixed length instructions. So a lot of the work in a processor turns out to be figuring out what the instructions say. When we're implementing a sort of processor simulator, a lot of your stuff is going to be just getting the machine code and figuring out what it means. And fixed length instructions make that simpler. Disadvantage is that this means that typically our programs will take up more space. So this means less compact machine code. As I said, more registers, because we're accessing memory sort of with extra instructions to do that, we want more registers so we don't have to do that as often, and also because that's a good use of sort of our extra chip space. It's just writing more registers. And then there's a few things that instructions generally won't do. So we're generally not going to have an instruction which does kind of like a loop. And you might say, there are no instructions that do that. I don't know. I've seen. There are. So like x86 has an instruction that basically does a string copy, for example. That is not something we would see on a RISC processor, because that's kind of a loop in one instruction. But it has been kind of common for RISC processors to support that kind of instruction. And also, instructions with two memory operands. So a lot of RISC processors, including x86, support some instructions which access memory basically twice, at two different places. That in a RISC processor, the design philosophy would be, we want every instruction to do roughly the same amount of work. So we're going to say, if you want to do that, you have to write two instructions. And another big thing is having few addressing modes. So by addressing modes, I mean ways of specifying operands. So if we think of x86 has a ton of these ways of specifying operands. So if I think of the add instruction, I can specify a register. I can specify a constant. I can specify a location in memory using one register. I can specify it using two registers. I can specify it using a constant memory address. I can specify it using a constant memory address and a register. There's tons of ways I can write tons of formats for each operand in that add instruction. A RISC-like processor typically will have one or two. That's it. And this is something where you can see the clear trade-off between, there's less to implement in the hardware versus, now I need to write all my assembly code differently because, I don't have all these choices all the time. Okay. So questions on these typical RISC properties? Yeah? Question is, if there are fewer instructions, how would someone know that you can still do what you need to do with those instructions? So usually the things you need to know you can compute everything are pretty simple. Like you need to be able to load and store memory and like do arithmetic. There, someone could figure it out. And usually the sorts of instructions that are missing are going to be things like, or that are going to be simpler, are going to be like push, for example. So a RISC processor often will not have a push instruction. Instead, you'll have to add and store as two separate operations. But it's clear that you can do that because if you look at the SISC instruction, it's just a couple of RISC instructions. That's typically what you'll see. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, can I explain what I mean by no loops within single instructions?
Yes.
So SISC-like processors sometimes support instructions like sort of x86 has a string copy instruction. That is something you would pretty much never see on a RISC-like design. They would say, if you want to do that sort of thing, you need to execute one instruction per step. We're not going to have sort of one instruction that kind of does this all at once. Yeah.
Why, again, is more registers easier to implement?
Question, why is more registers easier to implement? So the way I would think about it is that if we have some space on a chip and we want to fill it up, we could try to fill it up by adding more logic, or you could just duplicate the registers we already have to make them more. So that's sort of kind of conceptually easier. So it's relatively easy to implement as far as like using the space we should have for our processor. And I'm saying relatively easy because making a fast register file is not a topic in this class and is apparently difficult when we get to larger register file sizes. But also, you know, I know half of the reason for having more registers is kind of to compensate for the instructions being simpler. Yeah?
Can you give me an example of what you mean by separate instructions to access memory?
Can I give you an example of what I mean by separate instructions to access memory? Sure. So in x86, you can do something like add from RAX into, say, R8, right? And that will access memory using add from parentheses REX. So that will access memory using REX as a memory address and add the result into R8. That sort of instruction would not exist in a RISC-like ISA. Instead, you'd have to move the value from REX to a temporary register and then add it. And the same would apply in the other direction. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Can you explain
Can I explain why we would have fixed length instructions? So I guess we're going to get more insight into this as we go through the semester and talk about kind of strategies for implementing fast processors. But one thing we're going to see is that it's really nice if we can figure out where not only the next instruction is right away, but like two instructions ahead. And that's a lot easier with fixed length instructions, because if we have fixed length instructions, if say they're 4 bytes, well, if I'm currently at address 100, the next instruction's at address 104, then 108, that's really easy to figure out. If I have variable length instructions, I have to do a lot more work. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So, as I alluded to, we're going to be using a particular instruction set called YD664. This is something our textbook authors made, which is based on x86, but it omits most of the 1,000-plus instructions and leaves just this list of instructions. And two of them have been renamed. I'll talk about them later. Two of these you probably haven't seen. This C move and halt, so we'll talk about those specifically. The CC represents sort of a condition. So the CC here, this is going to be jump less than, jump equal, jump not equal, and so on. So just all the variants of jump, and the CMove instruction we'll see is a similar kind of instruction, where there's a CMove less than, CMove equal, and so on. So this is our instructions. So let's go through first this renamed instruction. So the move instruction, I say, is renamed. So why is it renamed? So partially, what our textbook authors have done is they're kind of following the RISC philosophy. And one way they're following the RISC philosophy is by trying to have few ways of specifying operands. And they're going to the absolute minimum, which many RISC processors do, which is going to be that if we see the name of an instruction, that tells us the format of the operands. There's only one choice. But this kind of doesn't work very well with the move instruction, because we like want to move a constant into a register, we want to move a register to a register. So what our textbook authors have done is they've divided up the move instruction into kind of sub-instructions for each type of move. So rather than have it saying there's a move instruction and it does lots of things, what they've said is there's a bunch of instructions that do different types of moves, but they're different instructions, and each of them only take one type of parameters. So the naming they use is they have called the instruction with the source, then the destination, move queue. That's the name of the instruction. And that source and destination is either immediate, which is another word for constant, a register, or memory. And we have three possibilities for the source, three possibilities for the destination. So we have this table of possible instructions we can get from that, and not all of them actually are possible. So we can't move anything into a constant. That doesn't make sense. So three of them go away. We can't have constant to constant move or register to constant move. We can't overwrite a constant. So this leaves us these six possibilities. We could have move a constant into a register, move a constant into memory, move a register to a register, move a register to memory, move memory to a register, and move memory to memory. And our textbook authors have said, well, moving a constant to memory, we're not going to bother. If you want to do that, you can move a constant to a register, then move that register value to memory. We've said, you know, that's not a common operation. We're not going to bother implementing it. You can do it if you need to. We're going to make our hardware simpler by not supporting that. And same thing with memory to memory. We're not going to support that. We're just going to say, if you want to do that, move from memory to a register, then from a register to memory again. So that leaves us with these three instructions. So we have immediate to register move, register to register move, and we'll show some examples of these in a bit. Then I have this CMove. So what is CMove? So CMove is an instruction. Sorry, yes?
Is it three options or four options?
Three options or four options? It's four options. So immediate to register move, register to register move, memory to register move, and register to memory move. So those are our four supported move instructions. If you want to do any other type of move, it doesn't work. There's just not an instruction for it. So next we're going to talk about this CMove instruction. So this is an instruction that exists on x86-64, but you probably haven't used it before. So it stands for conditional move. And the version of it that y86-64 has is going to be a register to register move. That's all it can do, but it's conditional. So what does conditional mean? That means sometimes it doesn't move. And in the instruction, we write what the condition is as kind of the postfix for the instruction. And you can think of it kind of as a shorthand for a conditional jump and a move together. So rather than skipping over a move, if our condition codes indicate that the last comparison result is less than or equal, we can do a CMove conditional move if greater than. And that will have the same effect. So this is conditional move if should emphasize this sort of last arithmetic gave greater than. So a big point of confusion I've seen in this class is people really want the conditional move construction to compare things. It doesn't. It uses some past comparison or arithmetic operation and decides what to do based on that. It does not compare the values that are its operands. It just moves one to the other or doesn't move anything. Yes?
Can I say it's like referring to the flags, like the zero flag?
Is it referring to the flags, like the zero flag? Yes. So last arithmetic, this means ZF and SF. Other questions? So we also had one other instruction you probably haven't seen that was renamed, which was HLT. So that's renamed to HALT. So for some reason, the people who wrote x86 assembly language decided that they couldn't have vowels, but our textbook authors do have vowels. And the HALT instruction stops the processor. So we're going to need that because we're going to have a simulator. We want to know when the simulator should stop. So we want an instruction that you can run to tell the simulator to stop. In real processors, there are instruction. This instruction exists, but it's reserved for the OS. It's not something your program would be allowed to run. Okay. So when I talked about these move instructions, I said the kind of goal of separating out them into separate types was that we'd have only one way of specifying the operands. But this kind of doesn't seem to work from what we know about x86 for like memory instructions, like register to memory move, because we have a whole bunch of ways we could specify a location in memory. We saw all those variants of the base index scale displacement syntax. And the solution our textbook authors chose is that there's going to be just one way that we're going to support. And that's going to be that we're going to have a displacement and a base. And you can also write only a displacement, sorry, only a base, but that's just equivalent to zero displacement. You just didn't write the zero explicitly, but the assembler will write it for you. This means you cannot do all the other forms. They just are not supported in YAD664. This is maybe not so great if you're writing assembly. This is very nice if we're making processors, because we don't have to figure out how to implement all of these. We only need to implement one. So also, all the instructions that aren't the move instructions, all of the instructions that aren't the move instructions do not allow you to specify a memory location. So the only instructions where you can specify something like this displacement base syntax to specify a value in memory are the move instructions. So we can't, for example, do this add. This add would read a value from memory on x86 and add it to R12. That is not something YAD6 supports. Instead, you'd have to write a longer sequence of instructions. Asking which of these longer sequences seems appropriate. And something we're going to need here is we're probably going to need an additional register to do this. This is kind of getting to why RISC-like processors have more registers, because, well, you end up wanting them if you're writing assembly. Give you a little time, check with your neighbors, see if you agree on how we should simulate this x86 instruction on our more limited YAD6 instruction set. Who likes some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D? Okay, so we have pretty good plurality on D. That's what I got. So, thing which, remember AT&T syntax, this is the source, this is the destination. And I've actually wrote out up here what the instruction does. So we first want to take memory at 10 plus R11, put it somewhere, and we have to do that with a separate instruction because the add instruction doesn't support that. It only supports registers. So that's our first step, and I put it in R11, which I'm told is okay. And it's okay to overwrite it now because I've already used its value to access memory. And then I add that into R12, and we're all set. Have that. Yeah. So questions? Yeah. Why is the first line invalid? So our add instruction, so all our instructions are only going to support one type of operand. So for adds and most instructions, it's going to be registers. So we can add, register, that's it. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
It saves that in R12.
Sorry?
Like it saves the add in R12.
Question, this saves the add in R12? Yes. R12 is the destination register, which we know because it's the rightmost thing on the line in AT&T syntax. Other questions? Okay. So I said that our add instruction can access memory, and I said that this is because there's only one type of instruction operands that are supported, and that's two registers. This also means that the IRemoveQ instruction is the only one which can have constants, numerical constants like this. I say non-address because, like, a jump instruction has a constant, but it's an address, as it turns out. And this means we can't do add 1 into R12. That's not a valid instruction because the add instruction only takes two registers now. So we can simulate that with an extra register by moving 1 into some register and adding that register to R12. So our overall property here is that there's only one kind of value for each operand, so you can look at the instruction name, and you know exactly what to expect. And we'll see that this is going to make figuring out what instructions do in our hardware a lot easier, because we'll look at the part of the machine code that corresponds to the instruction name, and we know what the rest of the stuff to look for is. We don't have to do any extra steps. So I'll briefly go over, so if we go back to our list of instructions, there's some instructions here that you're supposed to know, but since we're going to be implementing them kind of in a hardware simulator, it's worth going over exactly what they do. And these are going to be call, return, push, and pop. So we should go over exactly how do they work, how do they affect memory and registers. And these are also the most complicated instructions in this instruction set. As we'll see when we explain them, they are doing things that are actually more complicated than a typical RISC-like instruction set would do. So this is a case where the textbook authors did not make the RISC decisions. They included, supported these instructions that we'll see are pretty complex. So push and pop. So push subtracts 8 because that's the size of values that we use, are all registers are 64-bit. So it subtracts 8 from the stack pointer, and at that new location stores the value specified by the register operand. And the operand has to be a register. You can't, if you want to push like a constant, you need to move it to a register first. Pop accesses memory where the stack pointer points and adds 8 to the stack pointer. But it accesses memory where the stack pointer pointed before the push instruction happens. So questions on what push and pop do as far as memory and the stack pointer. Yeah?
You said that POP stores the value before the register operand, or?
Question, POP stores the value before the register operand? POP takes the value of the stack pointer before any changes and accesses memory at that location and puts that into the destination register. And it also changes the stack pointer. Does that answer your question?
So it takes the value of the stack pointer before the operands.
Takes the value of the stack pointer before the operands? It takes the value of the stack pointer from before the instruction changes it. It also changes the stack pointer, but the place where it accesses memory is what the stack pointer was when the instruction started. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
In this diagram, new values come from the bottom of the diagram.
Question, in this diagram, new values come from the bottom of the diagram. So in this diagram, our stack is this white region here, and our conceptual last thing on the stack is where the stack pointer points. And when we push, we add something to the stack, so the stack expands to include more. And when we pop, we remove something from the stack, so the stack contracts, and the stack pointer moves to a higher address. Does that answer your question? Yes. So the question is, when we start a program, we need to manually declare location of where the stack starts. So something needs to set the stack pointer register originally. And when we're doing our processor simulator, there's not going to be an operating system to do that for you. So if you want the stack pointer set, you'll need to do it on a typical like system where you're running normal programs with a normal OS. The OS or something about the standard libraries are going to set that up for you. Other questions? Okay. And I wanted to go over push and pop carefully because there's also call and return. And call and return are just kind of weird versions of push and pop. So call does a push, but rather than pushing a register value, it pushes the address of the next instruction. By next instruction, I mean that if I have call some function, and some say no op instructions, and my function is over here, the next instruction is this one here, the one after the call in my assembly, not the one we're going to run next. Because it pushes the address of that instruction, but we actually start running at the label 22. And the label is actually going to be represented as an address in machine code, as we'll see. And return does a pop and jumps to the address it pops. Yes?
So when you say the next address, do you mean what do you mean by the next instruction?
Question, what do I mean by next instruction address? So if this is my assembly code here, so I have call foo, foo is down here. Now I write call foo, the next instruction address is this NOP after the call. The thing that's on the next line, the next thing in the assembly after the call, like in text. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? Okay. So we have our instructions. I should say what they work on. So we have registers, and our textbook authors have chosen to only have 15 registers. You may know that x86 has 16 registers plus those like sort of smaller pseudo registers that are actually like part of them, like EAX for RAX. We don't have those smaller parts. Everything's 64-bit, and there's only 15, so R15 doesn't exist. We also have condition codes. So we have the zero flag, the sign flag. Our textbook has the overflow flag. We're just gonna ignore it. We're just not gonna implement it. This means our comparisons are gonna be slightly wrong. And we're okay with it. There's no carry flag, so our textbook authors made the choice that they just only support signed comparisons. If you want to do unsigned, too bad. We're going to have a value we call stat, which is going to be something used for our simulator to indicate if the processor is halted. We can think of, in real hardware, this would correspond to, like, the signals we send to, like, the power supply to control if the machine's on or off, that sort of thing. And we're also going to have a program counter, we'll call the PC, and this we could also call the instruction pointer. It's going to point to where we currently are executing instructions, so what the current instruction is for some notion of current instruction. And we'll have a memory. So we have a memory that takes 64-bit addresses and gives us values of those addresses somehow. Some questions about these pieces of state? Yeah?
Are all the labels of the registers the same?
Question, are all the label names of the registers the same? Yes, and we'll have a table of them later. Okay, so if we think of what we have in our ISA, we have a lot of properties that are typical of RISC-like instruction sets here. So we have separate instructions for accessing memory. If we want to access memory, we have to use MRMoveQ, RMoveQ, or push-pop. We can't use, like, an add instruction to add to memory directly. We have to do extra steps. We don't have any, like, instructions that, like, access memory twice or do, like, a little loop. And we have few ways of specifying operands. One way where we, you know, aren't really RISC-like is that some of our instructions are pretty complicated. So the push and pop and call and return instruction, from our perspective of what our RISC-like processors would consider complex, they are complex instructions. They aren't complex from the history of all processors, but for what RISC-like processors typically do, they are more complex than a typical RISC-like processor would do. And we also are not going to have fixed length instructions. So we're going to look at the machine code next, and we're going to see that the machine code has decided that it's not worth having fixed length instructions, so it's going to be a little more complicated in our hardware to deal with it. So questions about these properties before we talk about what the machine code is going to look like? Okay, so our textbook authors had this table of what the machine code for each of our kinds of instructions look like. And in this table, we have the bytes starting at the lowest address, going to the highest address, and within each byte, we've written out the sort of bits as sort of a hexadecimal number in pieces. So in the case of this NOP instruction, this means that the first byte's value is 0x10 or 00010000. That would be the value of the first byte of the NOP instruction, and the NOP instruction only has one byte. On the other hand, our, for example, push instruction here takes up two bytes. The first byte is going to have, we have the value A0 in hex, and the second byte is going to have some value that depends on RA for the first 4 bits, the most significant 4 bits, and a value, the value F for the least significant 4 bits. So questions about the overall format here. We'll talk about how the RA and RB works and what the CC means in a bit. And also, there's some instructions here where we'll talk what OPQ means, for example. Yeah?
Can you go over again why we have the F at the end?
Question, why do we have the F here? So all these bytes, this is an arbitrary decision made by our textbook authors. There is a reason when we look at the table of registers why it might be easier to put an F there, but it's kind of an arbitrary decision that they made. About, like, that there's an F here or that there's a zero here instead of some other value. They wanted to put, they had to put something there, and they decided that, you know, we're going to choose what value needs to go there. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
The blue boxes, they're for IDing the instructions.
The blue boxes are there for IDing the instructions? Yes. So our textbook will call this the I code. We can consider this kind of maybe a more generic name would be this is the primary opcode, where opcode is a name for something that identifies the, it's a code for the operation we want to do. And indeed, when we're implementing hardware, that's the first place we're going to look. And also, if we're doing exercises with machine code, that's the first place we're going to look. That's the most useful part of the instruction for figuring out the thing in the first place. Yeah?
Why couldn't the push and pop instructions have been just one byte?
Why couldn't the push and pop instructions have just been one byte? They absolutely could have. But a decision our textbook authors made is that they tried to put the parts of the instruction in the same place in all the instructions. So all our register A and register B values are in the second byte of the instruction. And this is going to simplify our hardware, because when you want to get a register A or register B value, it's always going to be in the same place, no matter the instruction. If we decided to make the push and pop instructions more compact, we could absolutely do that, but then we need extra hardware to deal with. Sometimes I get the register here, sometimes I get the register in this other place. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so let's first talk about these CCs here. So we have one iCode, one primary opcode for our move queue and all the conditional moves, and one for all the conditional jumps and normal jump. And the way this works is that there's a secondary opcode, this value that's in the lower bits of the first byte, that tells us which type of conditional move or conditional jump is it. And the value 0 is used for, it's not conditional at all. We always do it. So that's our R move queue or conditional jump, or sorry, normal jump. And otherwise, the value will be 1 for LE, 2 for L, and so on. I'm not going to have you memorize this table. This is something you look up when you need it. So questions? Our conditional. So we do something similar for something labeled opcue. And what our textbook authors have done is they said, all these arithmetic instructions, they're pretty similar. We don't need to have separate primary opcodes for each of them. So instead, we'll specify it's some type of arithmetic and have this secondary opcode specifying which type. So we just have this thing called labeled FN for function code. And we're just going to use 0 for add, 1 for subtract, 2 for AND, 3 for XOR, and that's all the arithmetic operations we support. Okay. So then we have our registers. And we have 4 bits to represent any time we use a register or an instruction. And as I mentioned, they're always in the second byte, so we always go to the same place. And there's this table of the number we'll use to represent a particular register. So REX is 0, RCX is 1, and so on. And we've just chosen this numbering arbitrarily. And since there's no register 15, the value F represents no register. We're not going to, I guess, in our textbook author's implementation, this is something that's going to have the value 0. We'll see why that is when we talk about how the register file design they propose works. And this F meaning no register, so is you can see why the placeholder is F and not 0 that our textbook authors chose for cases where register is not specified for RA or RB. Some questions on these register indices? Okay, so also some instructions need to specify a value. And there's a couple types of values. So for IRMoveQ, we have this constant, and it's always going to be 8 bytes in our machine code. Doesn't matter how you write it in assembly, it's going to be 8 bytes. That's what the machine code supports. We also sometimes have a displacement, also always going to be 8 bytes. For our jump and call instructions, we need to specify the destination. And that's always going to be specified as another constant. This one in a slightly different location in the instruction, that's going to be the destination address, where the machine code is that we're going to jump to or call. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so our textbook authors include an assembler called YAS, which will assemble for you the assembly to an executable. So it does ASM directly to executable. It, there's no machine, there's no object file in between. It just goes directly to an executable. And our executables always start executing at address zero, as we'll see when we do signatures. So here's sort of an example assembly file here. So I have a bunch of IR move queues. I have this loop here where I subtract RCX, which is 1, from RDX, which is initially 10, and check if it's greater than 0. And if so, I go back to the beginning of the loop. So this loop will count from 10 down to 0. And while it's doing that, we're going to add into RAX the value we're counting. So we'll add 10, then 9, then 8, and so on. And then we halt. So if I wanted to figure out what the output of this program is, I need to examine the registers when we halt. In the simulator we're going to be using, we're going to have a way of doing that. So that's going to be the primary way we're going to see whether programs work or not, by looking at the registers or the memory contents when the simulation stops. And we can run the assembler or textbook authors I supplied on this, and rather than outputting a binary file, it outputs the machine code kind of in as part of a text file, so you can debug things and read things. Like, yes, if we were making a real machine, we make this sort of some binary that we could load, but this is meant for you learning things, so it's going to be this nice readable format, which has the bytes of the machine code. And it's alongside the instructions that they were assembled from. So questions? Process here. Okay. So let's work on understanding how to convert Y86 stuff assembly to machine code. To start out, let's take this function. We're going to convert this function all the way from C code to machine code for our processor. And I have an x86-64 version of this function. It's not going to work. So there's something wrong with it that won't work in Y86-64. So what is the which of these is a Y86-64 function that's equivalent? Give you another two. And there's a bunch of problems with the x86 assembly. Like, the first one is that there's no instruction called move in Y86-64.
Thank you.
Okay, who'd like some, I guess? Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A would be an appropriate translation? B? C? D? Okay, I have that both C and D would be good translations. So we have to avoid, we have to take it, make the add only take registers. That's the only version of add we have. We have to use a register to register move and immediate to register move. We can't just use a plain move. And we have to kind of work around not being able to specify one as a constant by moving one into a register. And there's kind of two ways of doing that, depending which register we use. And I'll work with version C, which is our sort of more compact implementation, just because it's going to save us time converting this to machine code. So to convert this to machine code, what I do is I go through each of these instructions, and I go back to the table I saw earlier, and I just write out the bytes I read from the table. So for I remove Q, the first byte is this 3-0, the second byte is F, and there's some value that depends on RB, and the next 8 bytes are the constant V. So I kind of have this template here. My first byte is 3-0. My next byte is F and some 4 bits that are going to depend on REX that I'll have to look up. And then the constant 1. And because we always use little endian in this class, we're going to write that out as a sequence of little endian bytes. I'm writing the least significant, so not byte, with the lowest address. So that's why I have it 0-1 as the next byte. Because we have, you know, here this is the lowest address going to the highest address. And I'm just writing a sequence of bytes, as we'll see when we get our final answer later. So I look up what REX is, and we had that table earlier that gave the 4-bit number for every possible register. For REX, that number is 0. So I end up with this as my encoded IRMOVEQ. So this is the first byte of it, the next byte, the third, the fourth, and so on. Then I do the same process for the add instruction. So I look up that in our table. I know add is part of that opQ line because we kind of group all the arithmetic instructions together. So I have 6, a placeholder that represents add versus subtract or XOR, a placeholder that represents RDI, and one that represents REX. So I look up add in my table, I look up RDI in the table, the other table, the table of registers, and REX in the table, and I find out that it's 6070. So our first byte is 60 hex, our second byte is 70 hex. Then I look up return in the table, and I see 90, there's nothing to fill in, so I'm set. So this are sort of my encoding, and I want to write this out as the bytes we'd see in memory. So I just copy the bytes directly from what I have. So the first byte is 30 hex, the second byte is F0 hex, and so on. And I've highlighted where each of the instructions start, but in memory, there's not going to be anything special about those bytes. They're just going to have those values. I just highlighted it so you can easily see how the translation happened. Questions about this process? Yeah?
I just want to make sure the first, like, blue, 3, 6, and 9 are the instruction labels, right?
the question, the blue 3, 6, and 9 are the instruction labels. So our textbook uses the name iCode. I would say they're the primary opcode. So yes, they tell us what category the instructions in our coding table. Other questions? Yes. So question for relocations, we just replace this green part? Yes. So a relocation will just point to that green part and say, hey, when you're making an executable, replace that. And that will be something in our lab next week, actually. Other questions? Okay, and I'll give another example here. So here I have a function double till negative. So to translate this to the machine code, the label doesn't turn into anything. It's just it's in the symbol table, but it's not in the machine code. The machine code like only represents the instructions. So the machine code for the add is going to have R6, a placeholder for add, and two placeholders for REX. I look up what those are, and I see it's 60, then 00. And then for jump greater than or equal, I look up in our table. I find out that jump is 7. I have something for the condition. And I look up, oh, greater than or equal in our table of conditions is 5 here. So that's how I got the 5 part, and then I have to fill in the address, and let's say in this example that the address is 123 hex. I have to write that as a 8-byte little endian number, so the lowest address contains 23, the next address contains 1, the address following that contains 0, and so on. So questions? Process. Okay, so let's do the opposite direction. So here I have some machine code. And let's start out by figuring out what are the types of the first 3 instructions in this machine code. So someone tell me what would be a good thing to first step for solving this problem. Separated by 10 bytes each. So you're saying, oh, our instructions are up to 10 bytes. So I want to like separate this into 10-byte segments. So I like this idea. The problem is a lot of our instructions are shorter than that. So for example, if we had a halt here, that would be 1 byte. But I like the idea. We want to do something with how long the instructions are. Yes? Look at the first opcode. Yes, yeah, so conveniently, this blue part lets us figure out what row we're on in the table. And that's always in the most significant part of the first byte of the instruction. So the first instruction starts here. This is the most significant byte. So I look up row 2, and I'm in that row of the table. And from that, I can tell there's 2 bytes, because there's 2 bytes filled in that table. So those 2 bytes correspond to these 2 bytes here. So that tells me where the first instruction is. And since I know where the first instruction ends, I know where the next instruction starts. So I start at the following 6. So with that in mind, hopefully you can figure out what our first 3 instructions are. I guess we already kind of gave away that the first one is an R move queue. It's not a C move because 0 is the always type for the C condition code part. Okay, so can someone tell me what's the type of our next instruction? The second instruction. Yeah.
Like op queue?
So it's one of the op queues, yes. So it's arm of queue, some sort of op queue. It turns out it's going to be an add, but I don't have the table here, so I don't expect you to know that. And the one following that, yeah. Also an op queue, a different type of op queue, it turns out, but subtract. And the way we could figure that out is we look for the 6 here, and when we look at the 6, there's also 2 bytes, because there's 2 bytes in our table. And we can repeat this process to kind of identify where all the instructions start. And that's sort of the first step I'd have in decoding the instructions. Yeah?
Wait, for the move, do you just not include the register
types? Do I not include the register? I just ask for the types.
Oh, okay.
So eventually, we want to actually get the actual types. So what I'm going to do there is I'm going to go through each of these instructions, and I look at the fields and match them up. So for a move, I'm going to figure out, oh, 1-0, 1 is RCX, 0 is RAX, and I write out my move instruction. And similarly, I take my add and subtract, I look up what those registers are, and what type of add and subtract it is, and keep going. And I just repeat this process. So for example, next, I get to this instruction that starts with 7. So I say 7, oh, that's this conditional jump line. I look up what 2 for the CC field means. I find out it's L, so it's a jump less than. And I see the address is this big number. I convert that to like a constant I write in C, and I get 0x84. And I just keep repeating this process. And that's how I go from my machine code back to assembly. Some questions about our machine code to assembly translation? Yeah?
Wait, so for the exercise where the first 3 instructions, the first 3 where we're instructing the whole, since it was, if it's an instruction, it has the primaries, the blue, purple, and the.
So for figuring out the types of the first 3 instructions, we looked at that primary opcode, that thing labeled in blue. Yeah. And the reason why we looked there is because that was what tells us what line of this table to use. And that's our first step. It's hard to use this table if we don't know which line to look in. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Why are the destinations and constants 7 instead of 8 bytes?
Why are they 7 instead of 8 bytes? These should be 8 bytes. Did I label this incorrectly? If it's not 8 bytes, I labeled this incorrectly, but it should be 8 bytes because this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, so I just labeled this diagram incorrectly, and I will fix that later. Other questions? Okay, so I think I'm out of overtime, so.